Psalm 78. If you are listening along chronologically, then you know that we just finished our reading of Joshua, and we will soon be moving on to our study of Judges. We noted at the end of Joshua an unfortunate error made by Joshua's generation, a failure to impart their history with God and the importance of it to their own children. The children then forgot God and went their own way. For more on that, you can listen to our message from July 5th, 2020, Death of Joshua's Generation. We haven't yet studied Judges, but Judges will record the misadventures of the generations that followed. They often fell away, suffered for falling away, and then returned to God, only to fall away again. This psalm describes that generational phenomenon. It speaks to the importance of relaying the history of God's works to those who will come after us. It also reviews the history which we have studied thus far in the Bible, primarily focusing on the book of Exodus. But it will make mention of Joshua's conquest and the failures of the subsequent generations as well. The psalm was written many years later, during the reign of either David or his son Solomon, so it will briefly mention David's dynasty also. And herein we will learn some important lessons. We will see the mandate to teach our history to future generations, and we will learn not to walk in stubbornness, as former generations did. We will also take the opportunity to talk about Maskils and about Asaph, the psalm's author. Your passage then is Psalm 78, and if you haven't read it yet, I recommend that you pause and do so now. First things first. This psalm, like many others, has a heading. The heading tells us that this is a maskil of Asaph. That naturally raises two questions. What is a maskil, and who is Asaph? As for a maskil, we aren't certain of exactly what was intended by the word, but the word evidently describes some type of song form or part of the temple liturgy, or otherwise describes the purpose of the psalm. Taken literally, the word maskil means instructive. So we get the idea that this describes a poem or song whose purpose is to teach the listeners. This psalm matches closely with that idea. A person who learned this song would learn about the history of Israel, and in that sense it was instructive. Other maskils don't seem to match that so well, though. There are 13 maskils in the Book of Psalms. They have varying subject matters. There are psalms of lament, of prayer, of praise, so it isn't clear that the word maskil describes the content of the psalm explicitly. But beyond that, there isn't really anything I can tell you. The word is, to some degree, a mystery. The next question is, who is Asaph? There are 12 psalms attributed to Asaph in the Bible. After David, Asaph has more psalms in the book than does anyone else. David has 73 attributions. Asaph narrowly edges out the sons of Korah, who have 11. So this Asaph is a big shot in the Psalms. Now, it is possible that there were more Asaphs than just the one, but the prominent Asaph in Scripture, to whom we expect that these Psalms were attributed, was a leader of worship in the temple in the life of David and Solomon. We have it recorded in 1 Chronicles 6, 15 and 16, how David appointed him as one of the singers at the temple. Later, as we read in 1 Chronicles 25, he advanced to a leadership role with his sons serving under him. So Asaph was the founder of a family of temple musicians. Asaph must have been younger than David because he was still alive in the time of Solomon. But even after Asaph passed from the scene, his sons remained prominent as singers for generations. Even after Israel returned from exile in Babylon, Asaph's descendants were still recognized as singers when they returned. That comes from Ezra 2 and Nehemiah 11 and 12. So Asaph was a contemporary of David and Solomon. However, I have my doubts that he personally wrote all of the psalms attributed to him, because some of the psalms seem not to be contemporary to David and Solomon. The reigns of David and Solomon were arguably the most prosperous time in Israel's history, and yet we have some of the psalms bearing his name describing circumstances that are less than prosperous. Psalm 74 calls on God to remember Zion and not to cast them off forever. Psalm 79 describes that the temple had been defiled. and Psalm 80 described Israel as burned and cut down. Those negative circumstances point to a time after the reign of Solomon, maybe in the time of the kings, maybe during the Babylonian exile. So that leads me to believe that perhaps, when the Psalms are ascribed to Asaph, they refer not to him properly, but to his descendants. If a son of Asaph wrote a psalm, it might just have been called a Psalm of Asaph rather than a Psalm of the Sons of Asaph, and that would not be too far flung from what we see in biblical language normally. But who knows? Maybe Asaph did write all of these, and he just used vivid poetic imagery as metaphors for the trials that Israel suffered, even in their better years. Even after David ascended the throne, he did have his share of troubles, particularly Absalom's rebellion. So who was Asaph? Asaph was one of David's temple musicians. Barring any other good reason, we believe that this is the Asaph who wrote these psalms. But did he personally write all of the psalms with his name on them? Well, maybe he did. But maybe one of his descendants did, and they were simply attributed with his name. However, in the case of this particular psalm, I see no reason to credit anyone else with authorship. This one specifically speaks to the dynasty of David, and was likely written in his lifetime. The psalm opens with a poetic invocation, calling on the listeners to give their ears. And the second verse introduces the psalm's subject matter. The subject is a history, dark sayings from of old. Dark in that we no longer see them, though they have been said to us by the ancestors. History is a bit less dark for us than it was for them. Today we have video and audio recordings of recent historical events. We can see and hear what was seen by our forebears as they experienced the history, at least for the last 100 years. But even before that, our ancestors left behind images, paintings and sculptures and such. That was not Israel's way, owing to the second commandment against graven images. So aside from the written word, which was difficult to access, there was little to go on for history. And that, of course, made illuminating teachings like this one, delivered from the temple leaders, all the more valuable. It is also worth noting that the history described by Asaph was, for him, around 400 years old. The exodus from Egypt was about as far back for him as the pilgrims landing at Plymouth Rock is for us. Seeing that history will be the subject matter, verses 3 and 4 give us a descriptor of how history is taught and remembered. The things which Asaph will tell are things which the audience has heard before. They have heard them because their fathers told them. And so the new generation will tell their children. This is a world of death. There is no one alive who remembers the things of the distant past. We know the past only because those who came before us told it to us. Sometimes in words, sometimes in written records, sometimes in documentary films, but regardless, we only know because someone passed the information along. And so, as I have emphasized for the past few weeks, we also bear the responsibility of passing our history on to the next generation. To fail to do so would be to hide it from them, something which Asaph would not have us do. This history, in particular, is a most important one. It is one which tells of Jehovah's wondrous deeds, and which thereby glorifies him by displaying his might. Verses 5 through 8 expound on this theme of passing history from one generation to the next. Verse 5 cites the law which God had given to Israel, which explicitly commanded that the fathers should teach their children. This is likely a reference to Deuteronomy 6:7, which requires that parents teach the law diligently to their children. And, Asaph continues in verse 6, the intent of this is not just for one generation, but for children yet unborn to tell their children after them, perpetually handing down the history from generation to generation forever. Why? Not just so that they would learn it for the sake of learning, but rather so that they would know God, that they would know who He is and what He has done, and knowing that, that they would place their trust and their hope in Him, that they would obey His rules, that they would live their best lives. The alternative, described in verse 8, is that they would forget, that they would lack hope, that they would be unfaithful. A generation that did not know God would do wrong, and they would become set in their ways of doing wrong. They would be stubborn. Verses 9 through 11 tell us about the circumstances in Israel at the time when this psalm was written, explaining the need to pass the history on. The circumstance was that Ephraim had failed to keep God's covenant. We have noted before that Ephraim is often a representation of all the northern tribes of Israel, as opposed to Judah in the south. That's a theme that started in Genesis and which will run through the entire Old Testament. Toward the end of the psalm, this unfaithfulness of the northern tribes is contrasted against Judah's faithfulness in verses 67 through 72. There we read that God had rejected Ephraim, a son of Joseph, as the ruler of Israel, and had chosen the tribe of Judah, particularly at Mount Zion, where Jerusalem is. And God had chosen to build a sanctuary there and appoint a king there in David. And David, the former shepherd, is depicted in similar terms to God himself, as one who shepherds God's people. So Asaph is speaking to the people of his time. There is a need for him to recount the history, because a portion of the people had forgotten it, or ignored it. And while we haven't gotten to this passage in our sermons yet, you can find the conflict between Judah and Ephraim, to which Asaph is referring, described in its most overt form in the opening chapters of 2 Samuel. There the northern tribes had crowned Ishbosheth, son of Saul, king of Israel, while Judah had crowned David king. David had been anointed by Samuel the prophet, and so he was the legitimate heir. There was war between David and Ishbosheth, and David eventually emerged victorious. Evidently, Ishbosheth's leadership over Israel was not a leadership that produced good character in the people. Ephraim had forgotten their history and had been stubborn like their fathers, prompting Asaph to write this psalm. In verse 12, then, the history begins. It does not describe events in strictly chronological order, so I'm going to break the psalm up by topic. Verse 12 begins with the wonders done in Egypt. That, of course, refers to the plagues which God heaped on Egypt during Israel's slavery and their exodus across the sea. Of note, if you want to go back and read about all of that, it is found in the first 14 chapters of Exodus. We studied those from July to October of 2017. And Asaph expounded on all this in verses 44 through 53. He described how the rivers were turned to blood, how there came a plague of frogs and a swarm of flies, how the locusts ate the crops, and how the hail, fire, and frost destroyed what was left of those and killed their livestock. Of note, your translation probably has the word for flame translated as lightning. Either translation is possible. It is also interesting that Asaph included frost in his list of plagues. That wasn't described in Exodus, but evidently frost was a part of Egypt's suffering, even if it wasn't explicitly listed in the plagues. Asaph described also how the firstborn of Egypt were all struck down. He skipped several of the plagues, darkness, boils, etc., but he doesn't need to mention everything to get the point across, that God's anger was let loose and that he destroyed Egypt in his wrath. Verse 13 describes the great miracle immediately thereafter, that the sea was parted so Israel could walk through to freedom on dry ground. Verses 52 and 53 describe this as God leading his people like a shepherd leads his sheep, leading them to safety even when the sea overwhelmed their enemies. And there are, of course, two lessons which Asaph intended to impart from this recap of the Exodus from Egypt. First, that God loved his people enough to free them from their enemies, and that he had the power to give them the freedom they so desperately desired, and thus that he had the power to give them anything they needed. Or, the second lesson, the alternative, that having that power and having displayed that wrath, he could bring just the same horrors on Israel if they opposed him, destroying them just as he had destroyed Egypt. And this power was openly on display. During Israel's time in the wilderness, God led them with a pillar of fire and cloud. He gave them water to drink from the rock. So the picture thus far is this. God has power. He uses it for the good of those who fear him and for the bad of those who don't, and yet, despite that example, God's people rebelled in the wilderness. Primarily, this took the form of a refusal to trust God, which manifested itself in making demands of God. It wasn't enough for them that they got water from the rock. They tested God by asking for food, and not just manna, but even meat from heaven. Now, if you want more on that story, you could listen to our message Manna and Quail, published November 5th, 2017. But Asaph gives us a fair summary. God was angry that his people were testing him, and despite this, he gave them manna, miraculous bread from heaven to eat. And he gave them quails. He gave them so many quails that they couldn't be counted. He gave them so many that he overproved his power. And then he punished the people for their lack of faith, which had caused them to test him. And with that, they had a full picture of God's power and how he uses it. God's wrath wasn't only for Egyptians. God's wrath was for anyone who would rebel against him. That's the lesson of the history. Those who obey God get the power of blessing, and those who disobey God get the power of wrath, in a general sense. Verses 32 through 37 describe to us the cycle of rebellion generally. It goes something like this. God shows his wonders. The people ignore them. So God pours out his wrath, making life a terror for them. And then the people respond. They remember that things could be better. And then they turn back to God. But before long, their service to God becomes only lip service, not backed with a believing heart. This is not just a cycle seen by God's people in the wilderness. It is a cycle which we will see throughout all of Israel's history. Here Asaph relates in verse 54 and 55 how God drove out the nations and gave his people the Holy Land. But despite this, as we will soon read in the book of Judges, Asaph records in verses 57 and 58 that yet again the people continued their rebellion. They served other gods represented by idols in the high places. The book of Judges will tell us the story of a people vacillating back and forth. They follow for a while, then rebel, then are punished, and then come back. Here, Asaph describes those punishments in verses 56 through 64. God forsook his tabernacle, which at the time was at Shiloh. He allowed his people to lose their wars, and he gave them into slavery. The men fell in the fires of war, the women were deprived of their wedding days, and the priests fell by the sword with no one to lament them. But then when the people would turn, God would be roused on their behalf. He would, metaphorically speaking, awake as from slumber in a rage and would put down his opponents. So that's your preview of Judges. It will be a generational cycle of rebellion, punishment, and redemption. Such cycles continue throughout the scriptures. We'll see it in the reigns of the kings. In that era, the rebellion will slowly slide downhill to the point that the people will be sent into slavery to Babylon. But even from there, they will eventually come back to God and be redeemed with the faithful generation of Ezra and Nehemiah. And I dare say such fluctuations, large enough not to be clearly observed by us, are still at work in the modern day. The pilgrims were pious, and today we are witnessing a Christian decline. Throughout American history, there have been ups and downs, cycles of great awakenings and greatest generations, juxtaposed against decadent flappers and sexual revolutions. It is my hope that we're in the bottom of our current trough, and that we will see a Christian resurgence soon. Maybe a global pandemic, as we are experiencing at the time of this recording, will be enough to wake some people up. But as Israel went through the phases, God never fully showed his anger. In verses 38 through 39, he tells us that he did not completely destroy them. God was compassionate. He loved them. He forgave them. He remembered the inherent weakness of man. So maybe there is hope, even for a generation such as ours, that we can see a resurgence in future generations and have God's blessings again. He does these things for us. I will remind you that there is no requirement on God that he must show us any compassion. We are sinners. We deserve the wages of sin, death, eternal death, death in the eternal torment of unquenchable flame. But God does not destroy us completely. He loves us, he chose us, he forgives us, and he can forgive the sins of our generation. So then that gets us through the content of the passage, and I have two brief lessons for you, which I will not belabor because we have touched on them throughout. But first, it is essential for the propagation of our faith that we teach it to generations to come. We have that faith recorded for us in the Bible. Our duty is to cling to the Bible and to know it so that we can teach it to those who are coming after us. This is not just a job for church leadership. I can't do everything for you. Parents have a particular duty to give their children the same love of the scriptures that they themselves have, and to train their children so that they know the scriptures. So do not be negligent in this. Learn the scriptures, love the scriptures, teach them to the next generation. If our forebears had not done this, we would not have the faith. So we must do it for our children. And second, just as Israel learned the lesson of history, often the hard way, and as you must impart it to your children, so you must also learn not only the facts of history, but the lessons it imparts. The lesson is this. God has done great things by his power. It is a power which can help you or harm you. God loves his people, and if you will follow him as one of his people, then he will do good for you, in general. But if you won't, if you will make yourself an enemy to God and his people, you will suffer for it. My encouragement to you, then, is this. Do not destroy yourself. Submit to God and follow him and receive the blessings of doing so. To conclude, then, this is the 78th Psalm. It was written by Asaph, one of David's appointed temple musicians. Asaph wrote the psalm for the instruction of God's people, that they should learn their history and pass it on to future generations. And the history is this, that God brought his people out of Egypt with mighty wonders. First, he sent plagues against the Egyptians, and then he parted the seas for Israel to cross on dry ground. Thereafter, he brought his people through the wilderness, giving them food and water. But despite all these displays, his people rebelled against him and demanded more, and so God showed his wrath. When he would do so, his people would return to him. And the cycle repeated throughout Israel's history. We will soon study one of the most pertinent examples of this in the book of Judges. And so from here we learn both the importance of teaching our faith to the next generation and of practicing it ourselves.
For those of you who are listening to this message away from your computer and are looking for more like it, you can find us at eastjordan.church.